Welcome to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match, and your host. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Wendy Woods Swafford, or Dr. Woods of Blank Children's Hospital, and Dr. Heather Stefanski and Kelly Steffens of NMDP Be the Match. Together, we discuss the implications of recent research on relationships between hematology-oncology practices and transplant centers, showing support for the concept of shared and coordinated care to improve patient outcomes and experience. We discuss tips on how to build trust between providers, learning from the close relationship Dr. Woods and Dr. Stefanski had as hem-onc and transplant colleagues. We also explore how shared care can help overcome barriers and equity issues in transplant. To read bios on our guests and access additional resources related to today's episode, click the link in the episode description. This is part two of a two-part discussion. So we've been talking a lot about sort of the barriers and how coordinated care can kind of help overcome some of those barriers, but I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on the differences in barriers for pediatric patients, which I know you're both pediatric focused, versus adult patients. And I do know that this research focused largely on adults. So I'd love to hear your all of your thoughts on sort of the different challenges that exist in pediatrics versus adults, and how this research can inform both sides potentially, even though the questions were largely focused towards adult barriers.
I feel like in the adult programs, the numbers are greater. So the centers of excellence are more clearly defined, where it's not just, oh, you do have peds transplant programs close to you who maybe do 10 or 15 autos a year. Like, no, that's not what we're looking for. You know, we're talking about, a larger center that does, well over 100, 150 transplants a year to be able to talk about some of these more rare entities that we get exposed to. I think that they have far more options, what that care looks like, whether it's, an inpatient allo or an outpatient auto, which I'm flabbergasted to even have those say those words, but I know that they happen at institutions. There's the other barriers are what other diseases or what other complications does the patient bring to the table, and making sure the center has the ability to support those things. And I think one population you didn't mention that definitely is a struggle and definitely sets some transplant teams apart are that young adult population. So those centers that are willing to take young adults on the peds side, that is a huge benefit, because some centers, much like some pediatric specialties, draw that line at 18, and anything over 18 is now going to go to an adult program. It is really hard to treat a young adult in a pediatric relapse, in a children's hospital, and then suddenly at transplant you're an adult, and that model of care delivery is so very different. Or to send a pediatric patient to a program that you know has a blended transplant program, so your adults and your peds patients are on the same unit and receiving like same nursing support and same care, where it's not so much about is it peds or adult style as much as it is it's transplant. Those are all other pieces that fall into that that consideration of where you go. But I definitely think for kids, your options are less, and therefore your centers of excellence are recognized differently than in the adult world.
I totally agree. And I hadn't even thought about transplant with adult and kids being on the same floor, because I've never experienced that. And I'm also grateful that at the University of Minnesota, when I was there, we were able to transplant up to 25, because I totally agree that pediatrics is different. And I would say for the barriers, granted, there are so many more adults getting transplanted than kids, but I think it's just different, right? Like if your child is undergoing a transplant and you are a husband and wife, or husband and husband, or wife and wife, but you have a two caregiver style model, most likely one of those caregivers is going to go to transplant with the child and the other one's going to stay to work. Whereas with an adult, you know, if you are the caregiver or, and you then also have to leave your job potentially or not be there all the time. And then if you're an adult with AML and undergoing transplant, you're giving up your job. And so I feel like although there's financial burdens from a child, it's much more, I would guess, from an adult because that adult is truly not working and potentially that caregiver has to give up some time. But I also think with adults, it's a little more lenient, right? With kids, we really wanted a caregiver there potentially 24/7. That was not always the case. But that's just because you don't want an 8-year-old being by themselves all day. You know what I mean? Like, but some parents would have to go to work and we totally understood that. And then I would say the other burdens, chronic graft versus host disease is much more frequent in adults than it is in children. And that's most likely because of the stem cell sources that we use, which is either, you know, matched siblings or we use bone marrow, or we use umbilical cord blood, all of which have been shown to have less chronic graft versus host disease. But then there's other late effects. And so I feel like the late effects are also different because with kids, most of the time they're getting a myeloablative therapy because they can handle it. In adults, a lot of times it's reduced intensity or even potentially non-myeloablative. And a lot of times they're not getting the total body irradiation like the kids are, I would say. But yeah, there's definitely differences.
Definitely. And on that line, like, so if you carry your insurance and you're going to lose your insurability because of your, you're not going to be able to work and your job isn't going to carry you. Like we've seen that. And I've seen that in my young adult population who went to transplant. It changes things dramatically. And now, you know, you're approved at one center who now you're going to have secondary Medicaid support or Medicare support, and they're not going to approve your transplant center. Like we've had significant delays for those reasons. So that definitely is something we don't see in kids because we are very quick to help families apply for special kids care or Medicaid programming, depending on income. The other piece to that, and kind of going back to that AYA population, I feel like in our adult world, it's very more clear cut what they will and what they won't transplant or what diseases they will treat and not treat. So one of my most difficult patients had a Ewing's relapse, survived through both of those, and then developed a secondary AML in his young adulthood. But at the center where his therapy, his Ewing's surgeries were, was not our center. And they, you know, discovered relapse, consulted there with their adult team. They said, we won't transplant that. He'll never survive. And I was like, what? Like, what do you mean? Like, no, it's a chromosome mutation is like our data on it's really good. Nope. That's PEDS data. This is an adult. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's a therapy induced AML. Like it's pretty, I mean, not straightforward, but like, so put on this very palliative path that was awful, and came back and, you know, it's like, we're just going to support till he dies. And I just said, no, like I need you to go for a second opinion. And I thought the mom was going to punch me. Because they had just been through this awful encounter where they were told and palliative came in and hospice came in and presented this whole, like how bad this disease and death was going to be. And that he needed to get closer to home and get supported by his local oncologist. And here they come back and I'm like, no, I want you to go get a second opinion. But I want it to be at a PEDS site and a long-term survivor, like PEDS Center for Transplant, long-term survivor, which in that setting, our pediatric teams are more willing to think outside the box and push the limit because they know what the upfront risk was and they were willing to take it.
Wow. No, that's an amazing story. And that's another really clear example of how, you know, sort of that understanding and coordination between care teams is so critical in helping to overcome some of those barriers, whether it be for adults, PEDS, or the young adult population that is so complex. So that's really fascinating. So I'm curious to hear how you feel like these concepts of shared and coordinated care kind of connect with the ideas of, you know, I know we've been talking a lot about access, but also equity potentially in transplant. Yeah, I'm curious to hear kind of what role do you feel that shared and coordinated care can help play more broadly in improving access to care and even equity to treatment options such as transplant?
I think that it's really critical in understanding what's available at the transplant center and at the community oncologists, and understanding that there's definitely a lot of social barriers that come along with transplant, right? And is there a way to overcome those barriers? And we've done all sorts of interesting things in order to do that, whether, you know, you're getting someone else involved, whether you're doing medical foster care, which we've had to do for a number of patients, or, you know, an estranged uncle is finally, you know, going to be caring for this kid or whatever it is. But I do think, you know, we're trying to be better about it. And also financial barriers, right? Like insurance won't cover it. Well, luckily, we don't have as much difficulty, I feel, from the PED side because from an actual, you know, what insurance companies are looking for is actuarial things, right? Like if you can save a six-year-old kid, they're going to be able to be in the workforce for how many years? That's different for a 75-year-old person. You know, that's just unfortunate, but that's what it is. And so we can typically fight for that. But I would still say, you know, what research has shown is that, you know, if you already have biases that family's never going to be able to go through transplant, then you don't offer it to them. And that's not necessarily the right thing, because it's not even the HLA barriers that are going to be the problem anymore. We can overcome that. Mismatched unrelated donors, what we're doing with the ACCESS trial, and other things, you know, it's really going to be these other barriers that are going to take a lot more grants and money to overcome. Or thinking outside the box and saying, guess what, maybe you don't need a caregiver and we're going to have a nurse come check on you or something like that, because that's cheaper than doing it a different way.
I mean, there's another recent study that I want to bring up too that gets at addressing equity barriers, and specifically because of creating more of a collaborative relationship between the community practice and the transplant center. This was a study led by Dr. Vonsi Koda of Georgia Cancer Center, and they led this approach where their transplant physicians personally visited all of the practices in their catchment area. So, and they participated in these patient visits alongside each other. This was specifically patients with multiple myeloma. But then this one-year-long effort, they looked at, you know, the number of transplants performed compared to before they had initiated this. And they went from, on average, somewhere around 40 transplants per year to 110 in the year that the study was done. And specifically, there was a 147% increase in transplants among Black patients, as well as a 96% increase in transplants among white patients. So addressing that ethnically diverse patient gap as well, which we know is such a huge barrier just in terms of matching for ethnically diverse patients. So again, getting at that importance of collaboration there with that study, which was really interesting.
Absolutely. I think that our sickle cell population is a great example of that. There are sites that just say, we don't offer transplant to sickle cell. Like, you know, whether they talk about data is not strong enough, or, you know, talking about haplos as an option, or even some of the newer gene therapy as an option, you know, it's just, nope, we don't offer that. You know, these families would never be able to meet the criteria, would never be able to, you know, come to visits, be compliant or adherent or whatever word we want to use. Looking at options for transplant, for unrelated transplants in our African-American population, you know, one of my co-fellows and
from Vanderbilt when she went to her program in the southern part of Tennessee. One of the first things she did with her sickle cell program was she started going to the African American churches and strongly encouraging them to get on the National Marrow Registry and start giving blood and donating, and started hosting these combined blood drives and donor screening days at their local community parks to get more people engaged and involved and raise the awareness that this doesn't have to be the disease that we think that it is. So I think that there are grassroots efforts that happen on the pediatric side, that we do marrow drives when we have kids who don't come up with an initial match, whether it's because they're, a child from Russia who was adopted and we don't have anybody in the registry that matches, or they're from a Korean American family that is local. But there's a lot of Korean American mixed families in our area. So just increasing that awareness to increase those drives so that we can get more people registered to increase that opportunity. I feel like with a child, it's different. I feel like equity is, I feel like we're innately more aware and to make sure that children get have that opportunity for equity.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I mean, I have not turned down a patient for transplant, I believe, based on their race. But I will say we've had some frank conversations about, and I would say they're more difficult when addiction is involved and there's other barriers to overcome with caregivers, or mental illness. I would say that's been more of a problem than in my experience than race.
No, that's very interesting. So are there any other, you know, we're talking a lot about sort of how the, you know, the role that the physician can play in helping to overcome some of these barriers, whether it's on the transplant side or the hematology oncology side. And that research that Dr. Koda conducted, that example is a great example of something that a transplant center did to actively engage in outreach to their hematology oncology practices. But I'm curious, since, you know, you both have worked together so much, Dr. Stefanski and Dr. Woods, what is your perception of sort of the give and take in that relationship? We know that physicians are very, very busy, and it's often hard for them to wrap their heads around implementing additional outreach strategies or additional, communication components sort of in their day-to-day processes. So I guess what would you say, you know, from each of your perspectives, is the ideal role that should be taken, like, by a transplant center and by a hem-onc practice to kind of bridge those gaps?
And I personally think it's about building relationships. I think that connectivity at every level is that leads to our ultimate success, whether it's in practice or in our relationships with our families or just in life itself. You know, you are successful based on the people that you know and the team that you work with. And as a community cancer program, your transplant teams are an extension of your team. Like, you need them to be, and you need to have access to them. And developing that connectivity and that communication, if that's all you did, to the point that, you know, when Dr. Stefanski would launch a new trial, and a lot of them came with some perks as more and more of the pharma companies got involved, where she would say, you know, we want to make CAR-T more available. This is how we're working on it. And this company is coming to the table with support for families because we know they're going to be, you know, at the transplant center for longer, or, you know, we're working on our haplo studies and we want to get more parents typed, and we can do this typing without excessive cost to them, or we don't have to worry about insurance approval for the typing because we've got this funding approved to do the typing. You've got to have that connection with that individual to even have the conversation. So I think, you know, as a basic human necessity, we have to be connected.
I completely agree with Dr. Woods. I would also say that I felt a responsibility that if I wanted patients, I had to do my outreach and to make sure that I was doing the best for the patients and to reach out to the community physicians because they had options, right? You know, it was their, and it was their patient. And so I feel very strongly that I worked very hard at my relationships with my community oncologists. And not everybody feels that way, but I just felt like, you know, if I wanted patients, then I needed to do some outreach and make sure that we were available, right? Like you don't want to call someone when you're in a stressful situation about a patient saying, oh my gosh, this patient relapsed. They might be eligible for Kymriah. Can you get them in next week or today? You know, and we're not available. That doesn't even make sense. And so you just had to be available and open and do your best for the patient. And definitely like outreach is important, which is why establishing like tumor boards or leukemia meetings or whatever it is so we can discuss hard patients and you have all of the experts there. And similar, you know, like let's say, for example, at Blank Children's where Dr. Woods works, if there was a tumor board potentially that they were talking about a patient that could impact their treatment, then she would let me know about it. Or we might want to have the radiation oncologist be part of our discussion. And so really thinking about all the pieces and making sure that the experts that are making the decisions are there.
Absolutely. I think that sometimes the philosophy of programs and marketing is, here's our shingle, you know, we're going to let everyone know that we're here, or we have this super subspecialized transplanter, or we've recruited X, Y, or Z. And then it's just a expectation that these patients are going to just start coming down the highway. And it doesn't work like that. Like you can't overcome years and years and years of relationships with teams where that trust has been established, where repetitively, again, families come home and say, are you guys like besties? Because it seems like it in the way that you talk about each other, like, you know, their kids, they know your kids, like you can't replace just, you know, that the benefit of having those relationships with people. You know, I made a point if I was at a conference and I you know, I would always check and see when Heather was going to be there, because usually the BMT component was before. But if there was a chance that we had overlap, and probably the first 30 minutes was spent catching up on, she remembers every kid she transplanted of mine, or those families that maybe we weren't successful with, but like, have you talked to so-and-so? How are they doing? You know, did they have that second baby? How are things? Just like really an investment in our patients and in our practice. And I really appreciated that. Those are things you remember when you're getting ready for that next kid or you're thinking about things. You can't replace that piece because that's not fake. It's a real connection with someone.
It's human nature, right? That's what it is. And if you're easy to work with, then people are going to come to you. I mean, that's the bottom line, right? If it was really hard to work with a center where they had all of these expectations, you know, we might say, well, I wouldn't really say go somewhere else, but it would be a little bit more difficult. But if it's an easy thing and it's like, oh, yep, we've done this and, you know, this is our process, here you go. You know, it just makes things so much easier and so much better for the patient, which is what is critical. Because for them, when you think about it, right, like they've been in this one institution, especially when they're from a community practice, and now they're going to someplace where potentially they've never even been to a big city, right? If you live in rural Iowa or you live in rural Nebraska or something, and you've never been to a big city, Minneapolis is overwhelming. You know, and so how do you make that transition as easy as possible? And you don't do it by saying how scary the University of Minnesota is. You say, oh, here's the transplant center. They do great things. It's going to be different, but you know what? Like you got to embrace it and things are going to go okay. You know, like they have really great experts there because it's very scary for families.
Absolutely. I think a couple other pieces that I think about are, you know, having a strong oncology team with your transplant team, because there are times where, you know, best made plans, you're headed up for transplant and there's a hiccup and then you need the local support of the oncology team. It doesn't work if you only know the transplant side of that group. But also having that willingness to go that extra mile. I remember one of the call outs that I did to the Minnesota team. I had a failed T-cell in induction who was literally like progressing very rapidly. And we found a huge thrombus hanging off one of his valves. And there was a point where I was on the phone with the transplanter, the oncologist, an interventional cardiologist, interventional radiologist, the critical care team, the transplant doctor, and I can't even remember who else, but both transfer centers were on the line. And I think even the pilot who was going to maybe come get the kid was on the line with the transport teams. And there was one point where the cardiothoracic surgeon said, can you guarantee that they're going to make it here? And like, thank God the other, the transplant doc on the phone was like, well, hold on. And I was like, yeah, let me call God and get him on the line and see. Like, no, I can't guarantee that. Like, can you believe what you're asking me? But it was fortunately like their own team member was willing to call them out on this conference call and be like, no, that's why we're all on the line together. But just knowing that, you know, everyone is there and trying to do their best they can for this child. And I think that's a huge benefit of, again, being in a pediatric focused arena, where in the adult world, sometimes I get the feeling that that just would have been like, that's not going to happen. We're never going to, you know, this is not safe. This is never going to be successful. So we're not even going to entertain the idea.
Just the conversation kind of, it makes me think of two different patients that we've spoken to in a recent research project where we were interviewing them, and just how much work behind the scenes happens. And then that does create such a positive, more positive experience for the patient. I mean, this one patient that we spoke to talked about how she had received her transplant and had recently moved back to her community practice afterward. And she could clearly tell that her transplant team and her community team had not been communicating. And they were telling her different things, different stories. And she just felt so uncomfortable, scared, you know, not confident in the care. And then we heard from another patient the complete opposite story. And this patient described something that seems a little bit more similar to the two of you, Dr. Woods and Dr. Stefanski, where she said, I could tell that they had just been talking about my case. They're on exactly the same page. And it just made me feel so much more confident that I was in good hands. And so it really is apparent to the patient, whether that relationship is strong or not.
And even in the losses, like to have a team that's willing to call their home team and say, things aren't going well, and that sometimes happens really acutely. Some of them are longer and drawn out where it's like, you know, we already relapsed post-transplant and things aren't going well, but like those acute changes, those life-threatening or life-altering infections and acute septic events, to have them call and say, listen, I just want you to know, like, overnight things went bad, we're in the ICU, things aren't looking good, families being asked about withdrawal support, to as that local team who, you know, that could have been a 3-5-6 year journey with a family that led to that moment, to be able to have an opportunity to be aware of it and to reach out to that family and have some really difficult conversations about where they are and support them in that moment. It is human. It's the essence of why we all went into taking care of people. You want to be able to support them. You want to, as hard as that is, you're glad you were part of that process, because when you're not and you hear about it, maybe a couple of days later, the child has passed and you miss that opportunity to reach out to a family, that is really hard. It's really hard on your team at home, your whole treatment team. It's really hard as a provider who has invested, you know, a long and large amount of energy into that patient, you know, to have that relationship with somebody where they're willing to call you and let you have an opportunity to be a part of that. That is something really special.
No, that's a really, really great example. And I think that, you know, getting back to the research a little bit and what Kelly was sharing, this concept of having that sort of connection or that touch point, Dr. Woods, from your perspective, you know, and I know that you have a very strong relationship with a lot of programs and Dr. Stefanski as well, but an experience like that, where you potentially couldn't get someone on the line or couldn't be involved, do you think that those types of negative experiences or a lack of coordination potentially taints the concept of transplant for hematology oncology practitioners who may be considering it as a treatment option for their patients?
Oh, absolutely. I think that if you don't have a foundation of a relationship, and you have a bad outcome with a center, you know, there's so many pieces of this. Say that it wasn't your center of choice, but you made it work because that's where your patient could be transplanted. And then the communication is poor and that you have a negative outcome. That doesn't build ongoing trust in that center. As in that state, what you would hope was that center who knew that this was a forced hand by an insurance company, you know, you would hope that they would spend a lot of time building that relationship with you, over communicating with you, because at that moment they've heard all your rebuttals on why you were choosing the other center, and they know that they weren't chosen up front, right? They know that you have appealed and appealed and appealed and appealed, and now you're here. But that's not the way it works, and it's really interesting when you have. When your home team has a bad experience with a center that they don't have an underlying relationship with, it definitely taints your future options there. Even to the point that, again, it's not just about the doc-to-doc piece, because, I mean, I've worked with teams where people that I have known really well have gone and, you know, hung your shingle there, and that doesn't change one person doesn't change the whole culture of a center. It, you know, you have hope. But if it doesn't change the communication between the other team members and it doesn't change the way that the facility speaks about the community-based program, there definitely is a bias against community-based programs, in the sense that, oh, they're not academic, they don't think about these things, they're not X, Y, or Z, kind of this ivory tower mentality. Our families pick up on that. And I mean, they don't hesitate to share everything they heard about how awful your hospital is or how you don't have X, Y, or Z. And it doesn't build trust and confidence in the relationship you have. And it doesn't build trust and confidence in their hope that you're going to be able to pick up that post-transplant care. And even that piece of it in the post-transplant, when you could transition care back and you as a transplant center choose not to, that is demeaning to that community referral center.
I totally agree. I mean, I think, especially with, there are so many other options for patients to receive other types of therapy that, you know, may not be as good as transplant, but they could be pretty good and still get the patient into remission. That if you don't have a great transplant program and you're not willing to potentially go that extra mile or be a good communicator, then why would you go there? You know, because you don't trust them. And again, like, what if you have had a bad outcome or bad communication and they sent you back a disaster of a patient without any information? You just think, what is going on here? You know, and why would I send a next patient to that? Because you don't want to repeat that experience. That's just human nature.
For sure. I mean, I've received an auto back in transfer at day 12 because the family became too much to handle. Like, that's not the receiving back that you're prepared for. So, like, I, you know, at some point you have to also be able to work with the families that come to your site. But crazy things happen in that transition period. And you want to make sure that when you hand off your patient, it is like one of your children. I mean, you've invested a lot of time and energy to get them to a point that it's safe to transplant. And the odds are that success is greater than failure, or you wouldn't even be going that route, that the person on that receiving end is going to pick them up like they're their own patient and carry them forward until they're ready to come back to you.
I just think this is an interesting conversation, talking about how when there isn't that communication and trust, these toxic biases kind of pop up from both ends, like from the transplant center toward the community and vice versa, of, you know, ivory tower and non-academic and these things that just, that's what happens when the community or the communication just isn't there. It's fascinating.
No, absolutely. And I'm hearing a lot of things that ultimately come back to this concept of mutual respect, right? On either side, making sure that, you know, transplant center physicians and hematology oncology physicians, you know, they respect not just each other, but the practices and the culture of each practice, and, you know, are able to build that trust and understanding that you're colleagues, that there's no, you know, like you said, ivory tower on one end or the other, that you're part of the collective care team for this patient with the patient's best interest ultimately in mind. So, yeah, with that in mind, I feel like we've covered a lot of ground in this conversation. Do you all have any final remarks or comments on sort of tips or best practices for helping to build that mutual respect?
I would say it's all about communication on both sides. And really working, it's going to take you maybe an extra 30 minutes to write that letter that explains things, or an extra, you know, 15 minutes to make a phone call. But going that extra mile is going to do wonders for your patients.
I agree. It's no different than thinking about how we do patient experience. It's like provider experience. Making sure that you sit down and take the time to connect with that individual, making sure that you understand the venue that those families are coming from, and maybe some of the barriers that are there to their care. One of my favorite things about the different teams is a lot of people visit us just to see, you know, part of it, I think, is just human nature and curiosity. Like, so what is their program like? What's their clinic like? What does this look like? Just like we want to visit there when our patients are there and get a feel for what's your new children's hospital look like. You know, like, I don't know how many times I heard from our new families when Amplants opened, and they're telling me all this stuff, and I'm like, this sounds unrealistic. Like, you can do what with the windows in your room? And really understanding like the supportive services that they had offered with the, like, one of the things that the families talked a lot about was the alternative medicine, complementary and alternative medicine program that they developed. And, you know, we actually, as we launched our palliative program and started exploring things, were able to reach out to their team to say, okay, tell me more about how you got some of these essential oils approved. And I mean, one of the things that I frequently tout when I'm arguing for an alternative support is, I'll say, hey guys, if the transplanters at Minnesota support this, like, I don't know any more cerebral people in the world who would be anti-complementary medicine, but their transplant team is on board. Why are we not? You know, but just knowing each other and knowing their center and knowing what they have to offer, I mean, visit. You can learn so much from each other and about each other by just developing that connection.
No, absolutely. Kelly, any last thoughts to add?
I don't know if I have anything to add in terms of tips as someone who's not a clinician myself, but I just want to thank Dr. Woods and Dr. Stefanski. I've learned a lot from this conversation today.
No, absolutely. This has been really, really interesting conversation. I want to thank all three of you for joining me today. I think it really helps contextualize the work that Kelly has been doing and the research, sort of the trends that we've been seeing. And hopefully we can take away some tips on how to strengthen shared and coordinated care between hematology oncology practices and transplant centers. So thank you all so much again. Thanks again for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode series. For more information and access to research and resources, remember to click the link in the episode description. Until next time on Explore Cell Therapy.